Welcome to Conversations with Creative Waco, the show that brings you inspiring stories from our thriving creative community right here in Waco, Texas. I'm your host, Fiona Bond, and each episode we spotlight the artists, leaders, and changemakers who help make our city not only more vibrant, but more honest, more imaginative, and more hopeful. Today's episode is a special one. It's the day after Christmas, a moment when we can pause in a pile of discarded wrapping, reflecting on what the past year has brought and taken at the precipice of a brand new year full of possibility. This is a double-length holiday episode, and we're bringing you a different kind of gift to unwrap as we look back at a remarkable year and look forward with a group of guests whose creative vision and impact I hope you'll find as inspiring and hopeful as I do. Each of them applies their creative skills to the canvas of community, and they are each shaping generational transformation here that ripples well beyond Waco. Throughout the show, we'll add a dash of festive fun as creative leaders across Waco share their celebrations from the past year and their anticipation for 2026. Our first guest is someone whose work reminds us that creativity can be a sacred act, one that helps us tell the truth, remember with integrity, and move towards healing. Reverend Dr. Malcolm Foley serves as special advisor to the President for Equity and Campus Engagement at Baylor University. He's a theologian, a pastor, a scholar of church history, and author of The Anti-Greed Gospel, Why the Love of Money is the Root of Racism and How the Church Can Create a New Way Forward. Malcolm earned his PhD in religion from Baylor University, where his research examined Black Protestant responses to lynching in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He also holds degrees from Washington University in St. Louis and Yale Divinity School, and he co-pastors Mosaic Waco, an intentionally multicultural church. He's also a writer deeply engaged in the creative act of telling difficult truths with clarity and hope. Malcolm played a central role in the development of the Baylor Memorial to Enslaved Persons, recently unveiled in front of Pat Neff Hall, an important moment of reckoning and remembrance in the university's history. Malcolm, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
It's good to be here, Fiona. It's good to see you.
Well, A, I don't know how you juggle all of the things you do and still produce books. That's remarkable. But you work at the intersection of theology, history, and public life.
Yeah.
Where does creativity show up in that work for you?
Well, I mean, the primary, it has to, first of all. There is a, and this is one of the things I press especially in the book, there's a lack of hope, I think, in a number of our communities, I think, especially because of how rampant economic exploitation is. And this lies at the root even of the memorial at Baylor, because it specifically reckons with the history of racialized chattel slavery, a system that at its root was one rooted in greed. And that root is something that still plagues many of our communities and actively kills folks. So creativity is then necessary for us to think about what does it look like to build communities not of greed but of deep solidarity. That creativity is necessary on a day-by-day basis to kind of reimagine what community life can really look like.
And I love how you are often talking about how we, rather than I, do that process.
Yeah.
And that it's very much a shared and a community-wide experience from your perspective.
Yeah.
I see the pastor in you when you describe it in that way. The Baylor Memorial to Enslaved Persons is both a physical and symbolic act of change and a kind of turning point for Baylor. Can you share a little bit about the story of how that project came to be?
Sure.
And I know you were instrumental in that process. What was the origin of that process? And I can imagine there were lots of points along the way where it seemed like this was an impossible next step for Baylor.
Yeah, so these conversations kind of began a number of years ago, but I served as a student regent on Baylor's Board of Regents from 2018 to 2020. And it was in 2020 that the board called this commission to take a look at not only all the statues on campus, but all of the building names, specifically to reckon with Baylor's history of slavery. And so I served on that commission. We did that work, came up with a number of recommendations, and then I co-chaired the group that essentially put those recommendations in place. So that included us putting up statues of our first two Black graduates outside of Tidwell Bible Building, re-narrating Judge Baylor's history around the Judge Baylor statue, and then ultimately the memorial. in all of that, I tried to repeat what I call my three R's of reckoning, repentance, and reconciliation. That is, it's important that we honestly reckon with our past, and especially insofar as that past is evil, that we turn from it and turn toward one another. And then that actively needs to manifest itself in acts of reconciliation. It's my hope that this memorial provides a physical space that not only communicates that, but also inspires that creativity that's necessary for us to conceive of what a real just and equitable community can look like.
I love hearing you describe it like that. And I think it also invites us to sit with it. I mean, Literally there are seats in the vicinity, and it's a space that pulls us into both the story and also to pausing and reflecting and experiencing.
Yeah. And with that, I mean, it's a physical opportunity, especially to slow down, because, I mean, culturally, we're constantly walking back and forth from thing to thing, thinking about 50 different things at the same time. But the water, the seats, all of these things essentially call the person to pause and to reflect. It's only really out of that reflection that just action can really progress.
Can you say a little bit about the symbolism in the memorial itself? Because you've talked a little bit about the symbolism of the sculptures and the imagery that is already on campus and that was on campus, and that, you know, how the balance of the story that we tell about Baylor is being restored by, you know, through public art. What kind of symbols and, I guess, physical messaging is there in the memorial?
Yeah. So, for example, the limestone that we used is meant to evoke the image of the limestone that was used to build Baylor's original campus. There are a number of spaces between the blocks. The number of spaces matches up with the number of people whom Judge Baylor enslaved. On the backside of the limestone blocks, the texture on the back is to match the kind of hand-carved texture of those blocks from our original campus. Almost every detail of it means something. We wanted to place two scriptures on the left and right side, one from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament, to kind of map in many ways the history of redemption, from God freeing his people from the land of slavery in Egypt to Christ's words that the one whom the Son sets free is free indeed. Every element of this memorial is meant to evoke something.
Tell me about the water. That's such a powerful motif, of course, you know, throughout scripture, but also in the memorial.
Yeah. So it's an image of cleansing. There are also seven fountains, because seven's just a great biblical number of perfection. Right.
Yeah.
It's great. But not just the physical water itself, but the sound of it is also significant. So you hear this memorial before you see it. But that also means that it becomes a full sensory experience too. And experiencing it, you know, in the daytime and at night are also two distinct experiences the way that the light functions in the memorial as well. So it really is a kind of full body experience.
It absolutely is. And I also think of water as being baptismal, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is part of that restorative, redemptive process that you talk about. It takes us on that journey, I guess, you know, from ark to baptism. I love
it. It goes back to the people of Israel crossing over the Red Sea, the waters of baptism, the river that flows from the throne in the book of Revelation. There's a lot of redemptive imagery of water, not only throughout the scriptures, but those are some of the things that we want to evoke with the sound of it and the sight of it.
I love that it's flowing. You know, that, again, that metaphor of it's moving, it's changing, it's kind of taking us on a journey.
Yep.
That's really powerful. What is your hope looking ahead for both the way that people encounter the memorial, but also for your own work? What's next for you?
Yeah. Well, my hope, especially for the memorial, is that it fosters creativity. One of the things about especially the history of racialized chattel slavery, but also just the way that race functions, is that it opens wounds. And those wounds are not healed by time. Those wounds are healed by active treatment.
Yeah.
I think about which is really just me repeating my namesake, Malcolm X, when he was asked whether he had seen progress. And he said, no, you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6. That's not progress. You pull it all the way out. That's not progress. Progress is healing the wound that the blow made. And so as we think about, as we reckon with Baylor's institutional history and think about what institutional repentance looks like, we can also think about what institutional reconciliation looks like and what repair looks like. And so my hope is that this physical memorial can cultivate that kind of creativity.
So Malcolm, tell us about your most recent book.
So the book is The Anti-Greed Gospel, Why the Love of Money is the Root of Racism and How the Church can Create a New Way Forward. In many ways, it is a response to a lot of the anti-racist literature that's popped up, especially over the course of the last decade. And it makes the argument that at the root of race is not identity, ignorance, or hate, but it's greed. So that it's calling our communities to understand race through the lens of political economy, which then calls us to a much deeper commitment of love toward one another, but also of material commitment. And you can get it anywhere books are sold. It was just recently named the Inglewood Review of Books 2025 Book of the Year. So
congratulations.
So check it out.
Fantastic. Well, I hope very much that people will put that on their reading list for the new year. And what about you? What is next?
Well, my hope, and I'm writing another book right now, but it's specifically about hope. But my hope, especially a communal hope, is that we would build communities that not only recognize that the resources that we've been given are meant to be shared, not to be hoarded, but also that we would understand that our need is not a call to shame. Our need is a call to not only asking for help, but also giving us opportunities to act out solidarity. We're broadly in a culture that kind of idolizes self-sufficiency, and in so doing, we deny our neighbors the opportunity to love us. And this is my hope, especially for my church, but also for any community that I'm a part of, that we would build communities that are not only willing to share, but also willing to ask for help. And in so doing, we can build the kinds of relationships that can really be redemptive.
And that is, I suspect, going to be something of a theme through the show, because our creative potential when the canvas is our community is so much greater. And I love that, you know, that weaves through your work as a pastor, as a scholar, but also as a creative. Malcolm, thank you for everything that you do in our community. Thank you for leading our community through a brave and very needed process. And I'm really looking forward to where this takes us next. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, please, can you tell me your name, what arts event / creative endeavor / show you're looking forward to the most in 2026?
My name is John Fox. I am with the MCC Music Industry Careers Program. And that being the case, I am always looking forward to new and exciting and the growth of live musical performance in town.
Our next guest is someone whose leadership is rooted in service, vision, and a deep belief in what communities can become when opportunity is shared equitably. Andrea Bearfield serves on the Waco City Council representing District 1 and is currently Mayor Pro Tem. She is also President-elect of the Texas Municipal League, serving cities across the state, and holds leadership roles in numerous local, state, and national organizations, focused on equity, economic development, and community well-being. Andrea's commitment to public service continues a powerful legacy in Waco. Her mom, Mae Jackson, was mayor, and she has become one of the city's most consistent champions for the arts, STEAM education, and cultural investment as tools for long-term opportunity. Andrea, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Andrea, your advocacy for the arts always seems to me to be deeply personal. Where does that passion come from, and how did creativity shape your own journey?
Well, I have always been in the performing arts, always had a love for it. I started dance when I was 4, right here in Waco at Dot Hogan School of Dance, for the old schoolers around. When she retired, I kept dancing and went to work for her. She had a costume store here, so I've always been entrenched in theater. Pearl Beverly, who is with development here at Baylor, created Portraits, which was an organization for young people painting pictures with words. In 1992, I was one of the original 8 members of that.
Wow.
And it's just,
that.
Perhaps I'm dramatic by nature, but...
Surely not.
I mean, it's the introvert in me. But I've always loved what art can do for a person and to people. And with people. So I've been driven to it, called to it, driven by it. And I just think that it allows us to really be as free as we could possibly be.
I love that. And I think that's very evident in some of the things that you're championing in our community. When you think about Waco's future, what excites you most about its potential as a cultural hub, a creative magnet? Because I know that's something you talk about a lot, and certainly something that has been right at the center of how you have characterized this community's development as a destination, economic development. Not everyone roots that in creativity. So say a little bit more about what you think that opportunity is doing for our community.
Well, you know, in reality, Waco's always been full of creativity, full of amazing talents in any form of art, but certainly the culture and the depth of what sharing stories of culture does and how it builds and impacts and broadens a community. And we've done that since our inception. The products and processes of, you know, the original indigenous tribes, the movement of the river, which brought folks in and out, folks of all cultures, which allowed different presentation of things that are joyous, of things that are sorrowful. All of those things are creative, and that builds who Waco was, is, and will be. I think that it's important that we shine a light on the assets that we have, and one of the strongest things that we could ever have in this community is its people and the voice of its people. You run a laundry list of tremendous talents that have gone on to do amazing things in this world that were rooted in Waco, Texas. And it's not hard to believe, but it's kind of like, huh, I never would have thought. And if we can continue to showcase what we have and what we've always had, I think that it presents an opportunity to advance us economically, because we'll shine a light on the amazing artists we have here, the amazing makers that we have here, and continue to build our story. Because I think the strongest thing that we do is storytell well. We have to make sure that we continue to do it, because as people pass away, and if it's not written, it dies. You know, but we've done a really good job. I know, you know, with the Waco History app and with the Texas Collections and those things, we are able to hold tight to the lore of our community and continue to build on that. But that brings a different flavor that is all Waco. And that creative spark, it encourages people to stick around, to come, to make roots here and continue to be a part of that tapestry and to sew their part into our legacy and that future colorful quilt that is the creativity and culture of our community.
I love that language of like being a cultural crossroads, a cultural, you know.
I mean, literally.
Yes. You know? And actually, even in indigenous times, learning from the Wichita and affiliated tribes about, you know, how this part of the world was where different indigenous tribes would gather and have their the Plains Indians meeting with the farming Indians would happen here in Waco, because it was where all those geologies collided.
That's right.
So hearing you talk about that as kind of Waco's future too is powerful. So you are the creative vision behind the new STEAM Center, Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math, which also anchors its identity around two of Waco's heroes. You were just talking about, you know, those extraordinary people. So Doris Miller and Jules Bledsoe. It's opening in January, right in the new year, and the whole community is invited to participate in that opening. That represents a major investment in curiosity, learning, and possibility. Why is a center like that needed, and what do you hope it will do?
So, one, I'm stupid excited about this.
It's looking amazing.
If I'm the STEAM Center's mama, then I have been pregnant for 8 years, and it is finally time to deliver this baby. I'm a big proponent of children can only be what they see, right? And as we look around and what challenges we have in education, what we have in accessibility, what we have in availability as far as tomorrow and the future, what do we do? Because we can't depend on one set of people to do everything. So it's not just the responsibility of the ISDs to bring our children to the next generation. It is, I mean, it is, but it's not just their responsibility. It takes a village.
Yeah.
So what could we do to make that better? Well, the short version of the long story is my son was at a summer camp. We found a hip-hop architecture camp in Dallas, and it was every Saturday for 6 weeks. And so we drove to Dallas every Saturday. And it was held in the Dallas Community Center's Teen Tech Center. And I looked, and I was just elected. So, you know, we're brand new. We're full of vision and
none of the barriers are preventing anything yet.
You know, there is nothing we can't do. We can absolutely solve the world today. And I said, well, we can do this. I was like, you know, it was 3D printers and the digital labs and robotics. I was like, we can do this. And so I went to the city manager at the time, Wiley Stem, and I told him. He was like, okay, I don't know how this is going to happen, but okay. And at that time, the Bledsoe Miller Community Center was the only community center that had not been renovated. So that was a plan anyway. But we had an opportunity to do something that would be generationally impactful. So what happens if we put STEM education at someone's fingertips? You know, because there's stuff available all over, but everybody may or may not be able to attain it, afford it, physically get to it. So, you know, if we could solve for this, then let's do it. So we started looking. We have combed this earth about for programming that are STEM and STEAM focused. I use both interchangeably because it depends on what funder I'm talking to, so we don't want to offend anybody.
And it is indeed a continuum because the A in that is
arts, creative process, which you need to be innovative. And the purists will say that arts are in everything, so I don't have to add the A, but there's no way that I can't have an A, not have the A in a building that bears Jules Bledsoe's name.
I adore you for making sure the A is in the STEAM.
1,000%.
Thank you.
You know, so we had an opportunity to say, okay, so, but it's not just our young people who need to make sure that they stay technologically savvy. So the format and the audience for the Bledsoe Miller STEAM Center for Excellence is K to grade. So from our babies to our elders,
I love that.
There's an opportunity for you to
totally stolen that phrase, K to gray.
That's our deputy city manager, Deidre Emerson's. my phrase is edutainment, and I stole that from somebody else, so we'll figure it out. But we have an opportunity to enhance what is forward-facing in technology for everybody. There's something that will be literally for you, for me, for my kids, for the grandparents, everybody. From robotics, as I said, we have an immersive lab. We have a recording studio. We have a full culinary teaching kitchen. There will be a digital lab, computer lab, esports space, gaming space. We have an immersive lab. So, you know, when Fiona wants to go home without actually crossing the pond, we can go in the immersive lab and type in.
Do virtual reality Europe.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Virtual reality Europe at any point in the STEAM Center. What I'm most proud of is that, you know, this building, the building itself was over 53 years old and served as a cornerstone in the community for personal development, you know, community pride. Mm. And today we have an opportunity to leverage that legacy through STEAM education.
And really to level up what our community has access to.
I love the
approach to lifelong learning. And presumably that also means that part of the learning will take place intergenerationally.
Absolutely.
As well, and which is powerful.
Transformation Waco, who is an amazing nonprofit in our community that was serving as wraparound services for Waco ISD when it was in district charter, is our partner in curriculum building and management and operation of the STEAM Center. And throughout the year, in the first year of curriculum, there are multi-generational and intergenerational programs that are set, not just for parents, but for grandparents and for bonus parents and aunts and uncles. You can really get hands-on and work with young people as well as do it independently. I think that, you know, we have an opportunity to equip our citizens with the skills, confidence, and imagination that they need to survive. I mean, because...
And to empower them, I mean, not just to survive, but thrive from what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Strive for things that they may not know. I was talking to someone yesterday, Councilmember Josh Borderud. His sister is a lighting engineer for some of the world's biggest entertainers. And I don't know that I would have thought about that as a young Andrea, that was a possibility for me. And so if I can showcase those types of jobs, those types of creative opportunities that pay really, really well. Mm-hmm. What does that look like?
And that are needed now by
that
every
are
industry.
In every industry. What does that look like changing the trajectory of what Waco believes that is available, mm-hmm. what it deserves, what it has access to? This world is full of on-ramps and exit ramps. So what does your on-ramp look like? You know, and this is a great opportunity for us to build, for Waco to build what's next, and for us to make legacy meet leverage, right?
Oh, I like that.
And add Powerful. To what our future generation will look like.
Andrea Bearfield, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for what you're doing in our community. Thank you for the boldness of that vision and bringing it to reality. I'm excited for that opening.
Thank you.
And so the opening will be?
January 16th, 10 a.m.
The ribbon cutting. Come join us.
Please.
We're excited to have done the internal and exterior artwork.
Yes. Thank you, Creative Waco,
augmented
for
reality
everything that you all have done to make it possible. You all are going to love what it looks like. It is incredibly representative of our community.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Bubba Waco. I am a multimedia artist, and I'm really looking forward to a production at Baylor called See How They Run for 2026.
My name is Jeff Castleberry, and I'm looking forward to the Waco Indie Film Festival.
If you're just joining us, this is Conversations with Creative Waco. I'm your host, Fiona Bond, and you are listening to KWBU, your NPR station for the heart of Texas. Our third guest today represents a new generation of creative leadership in Waco, one that understands how storytelling, media, and performance intersect with sustainability and opportunity. Taylor Vega is the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Baylor University School of Music. He's got a background in film, commercial editing, and brand strategy, and brings a digital-first, audience-driven approach to how music institutions can connect with the wider world. He's a lifelong musician and creative professional, and Taylor has worked with national brands, led major content strategies, and now calls Waco home along with his family. He sees enormous potential for music, media, and the arts as engines of community and career development. Taylor, welcome.
Thank you, Fiona. This is an honor to be here.
Well, Taylor, you've talked about music education as a content engine and a talent pipeline. Tell me a little bit about your creative journey and how you ended up here in Waco, Texas. This was maybe an unexpected move for someone who'd watched your career up to this point.
That's true. I run into a lot of people here in Waco that have a similar story. We call it lost in Waco. they say, how did I get here? And even more spiritual than that is I was called to come here. I don't know why, but I'm here for a reason. And I do really believe that and feel that. I am from Dallas, spent a lot of time in Dallas, went to University of North Texas, and worked down in L.A., worked in Dallas, worked in Hawaii for a bit. But there's something special about this place, and I can't wait to see what we can create together. So,
now, you are a musician, a filmmaker. You've produced many kind of media productions. So how do you come to be working at Baylor School of Music?
Sure. So I'm a musician in my life.
Well, I guess that there's a clue in that,
sure.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
somewhat professionally, to be totally cavalier about it, it was close. I was working at a big ad agency in Dallas. It was really great there, photographer there and a content strategist there. And the commute was just too much. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, about 18 months and commuting every day, almost 6 days a week sometimes. And my wife and kids were here, and there was always an empty place at the table at dinner. And, you know, my wife is so wise. One night she said, this really isn't working. Your kids are used to you not being here. So on a whim, I looked up job opportunities at Baylor, and this was on there, and it was just singing my name. So
wow,
I know. So I
wise wife,
exactly.
A props to her.
It's true, yeah.
And yes, the opportunity just at the right moment.
It's true, and you know, I studied music performance, vocal performance at UNT my first year, and when I graduated high school in '98, I wanted to come to Baylor, but couldn't afford it, and so now I'm here though. So 20-something years later.
And they're paying you this time.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's a good way around to have
it. It's true. Yeah, so.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your vision for music as a catalyst, not just in terms of your own promotion of the Baylor School of Music, but also what is the place of the Baylor School of Music in the wider world, in our community and beyond?
Sure. So let's start locally. I'm new. I've been at Baylor about 8 months, but I talk to so many people, alumni, current students, staff and faculty, that talk so much about how music is such a part of the Baylor experience through our history currently and kind of where we're going for the future. And the Baylor School of Music is poised to offer that service, offer that really human experience to all the students and local community here at Baylor. We put over 300 performances on a year.
And there are only 365 days in the year.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
that's intense program.
It's true. Yeah, there's a lot to do. But I think that's one of our value propositions at Baylor School of Music is the opportunity for students to perform. You might go to another big school, big music school, and never have that opportunity. Or if you do, it's, you know, few and far between. The other value proposition, I think, is collaboration. So not only are students able to perform in a way that they wouldn't at other schools, they can do it with other ensembles, with other students. And I just think there's such a human thing about music. There's such a spiritual thing, biblical thing about music. It's something that can speak to different languages, different socioeconomic status, different cultures around the world, and really bring us together. Another thing about music students and students at Baylor, you know, we have music majors, we have secondary majors. We also have a lot of students that aren't music majors that are just in ensembles and D1 athlete musicians just because they love it.
And probably need it.
That's right. And I'm obsessed lately with this concept of how music can inform the other things that you do.
Well-rounded education.
That's exactly right. And I don't know the actual scientific studies, but, you know, playing an instrument makes you a better surgeon. You know, being a composer makes you a better pilot, you know, that kind of thing.
I love that perspective. And so similarly, you know, just as music makes us a better-rounded individual, it seems like your vision is that music also makes us a more well-rounded community. Say a little bit about your vision for the engagement of the wider community with what Baylor is doing, but also Waco's potential.
Sure. I have a dream that Waco would be the next big music city.
So not ambitious at all.
No, not at all. There are definitely some analogs out there. I mean, Nashville is its own thing. But I think Waco's special. I think we don't have to be like Austin or Nashville. We can create our own trajectory and already have that embedded in us. There's this concept of like the upper room in the Bible, right? And this incense that is still lingering in there from an ancient time. There's something here about Waco. I don't know if it's from the Word Publishing or, you know, all the great music that we've had here all the way back to indigenous people like we talked about earlier. But there's something that is still sort of lingering here that I think we sort of need to tap into.
Cultural center of gravity.
That's right. Yeah, well said. I think a lot about economic development in regards to music. One thing I've been thinking a lot lately about is kind of fair wages. You know, a lot of musicians that graduate from Baylor don't stay here, and there's not the infrastructure, too, that maybe Nashville or Austin does. So I would love to, my vision is to have some kind of way to compensate them, infrastructure where they can make a living as musician, as an artist here in Waco, if that's the Waco cap. I don't know, but I'm hoping it is. So.
Which, of course, is the Performing Arts Center. And the guest after you on this show is going to be Tom Balk, who is helping to lead that charge. Right. I'm so thrilled that this might be the opportunity for the two of you to meet and make something amazing happen. So I've got a million questions that flow from talking about the potential for Waco to be this hub that helps to catalyze careers in music. And of course, we're a music-friendly city and, you know, have started that journey. But I'd love to hear more about what that might look like and what that might mean for our music community. What might that mean for a student that comes to Baylor, say, to study music? Because we've been almost on the cusp of being able to do that before, but haven't quite got there.
Yeah. I think we need the space. We need to build the space for
infrastructure,
that.
Infrastructure,
that's
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think it comes back to infrastructure and economic development, really. If I'm a musician graduating from Baylor, or I'm a musician coming here because I know there's opportunities, I think that just helps the city in so many ways, in ancillary ways, in foundational ways. I think the creativity can be the driver. I'm obsessed with this book, The Artist's Way. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have listened to it, but just this idea that as artists, this is something we need to do or we'll feel like we'll die. So
it's like an itch you have to scratch.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if we can provide for our families and still do that, what a blessing.
Well, and I love that your vision for Waco is a place that nurtures and catalyzes, I guess I'm mixing my metaphors there, but the next generation of musicians is thoroughly rooted in its history also. I know one of the things that we're talking with our mayor about at the moment is that Waco was such a central point for a lot of the emergence of blues music in Texas. Of course, we've been a hub for sacred music, both in the gospel tradition. And, you know, we have the largest archive in the world of black gospel music, which is remarkable. For a city our size, we punch above our weight, both in music history and, you know, some of the touch points, which I think potentially get us to that reputation of being an anchor.
That's true. That's where I hope to come in at the Baylor School of Music, is that visibility and notoriety, letting the nation and the world know in other ways, in better ways, that we are here and what we're all about. I come from a digital marketing background, so content is very important.
And that's storytelling.
It's true. Mm-hmm. And we live in an era with interest media algorithms. So we need to tell those stories and create content in a way that can reach new listeners.
And discoverability is huge for that. You were talking about one of the barriers to keeping talent in this community being that, you know, often the opportunities are elsewhere. We are working with you and the rest of the creative community to onboard a new platform that will make creatives in Waco discoverable, not just in this community, but across the state, across the nation. So we'll be talking about that a little bit in a minute. So two questions as we wrap up this part. One is, how can people find out about the music, you know, the public-facing part of Baylor's music program? And also, what is your hope for the year ahead of us?
Sure. Well, we're on the School of Music website, the events page. All of our events are there. You can download them to your device. And definitely sign up for tickets when we drop tickets. We're working on new ticketing strategies inspired by the Glastonbury Music Festival.
I love that.
Again, no big deal, but certainly learn some tactics from them. And I would say come to as many shows as you can. We offer so many different types of music and help us spread the word.
That's truly something for everyone.
It is true,
yes.
Yeah. I think a lot of people think classical music isn't for them, but I would say, well, one, it is. It's for all of us, but there's also different genres and different types of music that come out of the School of Music.
I do love the idea of creating a kind of perpetual Glastonbury feel for music in Waco, starting with Baylor.
Yeah.
And also, it is very discoverable. I mean, truly, most of the performances are free of charge or very affordable. And this is your opportunity to hear the next famous person and say, I heard them before they were a household name.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's so much support for Baylor Christmas just happened. That was a huge hit. And that gets broadcast, you know, across the nation. So people know about us, but I want more people to know about us, and I want more people to know more about what we do.
Well, I love that your vision for expanding the discoverability and accessibility of Baylor music goes hand in hand with the infrastructural development that's happening in Waco that potentially makes us one of the best festival cities in the southern U.S. So I think those are really exciting visions to blend together.
I agree. Thank you. Yeah, I think people want an IRL experience, but they also we need to be able to blend that well with a digital experience. And I think that's really where we can shine.
Well, thank you so much, Taylor. Thanks for what you're doing. Thank you for moving with your family to Waco. And we really look forward to seeing how you unpack those opportunities for us in the year ahead and beyond.
Thank you. I'm honored, and I can't wait to see what happens.
Hi, I'm Marissa McGuire. I'm the general manager for the AC Hotel in Waco. This year, we had a great opportunity to partner with Creative Waco as the Alebrije sponsor for the Dia de los Muertos parade. And my favorite part was being able to host the kickoff event at the hotel featuring the real live spirit animals all dressed up in their costumes. And it was really just an amazing way to bring awareness to those no-kill shelters. And so I'm really looking forward to continuing that partnership going into the next year.
Our final guest in this special holiday edition of Conversations with Creative Waco is quite literally helping to shape the city itself. Tom Bulk serves as Director of Strategic Initiatives for the City of Waco, where he leads major planning, placemaking, and public-private partnership efforts. A registered landscape architect by training, Tom has been instrumental in some of Waco's most transformational projects, from riverfront development to trails, public spaces, and now the next phase of downtown revitalization. He also played a key role in Creative Waco's earliest public art efforts, including the Waco Sculpture Zoo, and he continues to be a visionary partner in thinking about how culture and design shape civic life, how we interact with each other, and how our city is shaping itself for the future. Tom, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Tom, your work spans planning, design, and long-term vision. When you look at Waco today, it's remarkable how far we've come. How does that connect with your creative muscle that you get to make the canvas our whole city?
It's been a real exciting time to be in Waco for a lot of reasons. Obviously, coming in 2009, we were in a completely different place, but opportunities and ideas and a public expectation that we can do more, it just really has taken root and blossomed. And I've so enjoyed the trajectory that the city has followed because it's put me at the table for a lot of really interesting, unexpected conversations that are so impactful to our future. So you gave the example of the sculpture zoo. Like, that by itself wasn't a primary project for any department of the city, but has become such a touchstone of what people love as they enjoy this key riverfront in Waco's front yard, essentially. And so that's just one example of many examples that have come to the fore. And now here I find myself at the helm, project managing this downtown redevelopment project that literally will shape the fabric of our downtown and our city and kind of the outward expression of its identity for, the terms that we use are not just generationally, but for the next 100 years. So taking that mantle seriously and trying to surround ourselves, and this is true for all those examples I just gave, we find ourselves at the table with some of the best minds, the most committed folks, people that open our eyes to the things we didn't know. Well, this project tries to do that very intentionally by putting the most talented, skilled consultants at the table with us too. So it's really a continuation of the same effort, but with a larger project footprint and some new voices at the table, which is really exciting.
Why is it important that we have a density of development in our downtown area? What does that bring to our community? And how are you sequencing that? How is that flowing in terms of what have we already done and what is immediately in front of us?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, these are fundamental questions I get asked all the time. And so I think it's twofold. I mean, cities, they endeavor to provide the quality of life that people expect and want. And at the same time, they have to do it in ways that are smart and pay for themselves. Help a city manage the business of its wide portfolio of responsibilities. And so, and
presumably distinctive too, so that it's not carbon, we're not cookie cutter.
That's right. So in this case, the quality of life factor is like, you know, people will take pride in and enjoy and use a downtown that is well invested in, is highly walkable, all these things that we enjoy about the cities that we visit, that, you know, Waco has a lot of charms and a lot of great businesses and things, but we do not brag or argue that we have a highly walkable downtown. So these are things that we can move in the direction of that serve quality of life, but more importantly, in managing that wider portfolio responsibly, the downtown in most cities ends up being one of the highest contributors to tax revenues in terms of supporting the growth and maintenance of your street network out in the suburbs and things like that. So it really has a bottom line that touches everyone, whether they visit downtown or not. But the key to unlocking that contribution and that strong revenue is really making sure that it's a high quality district that people love to visit and walk around in. So like these two things go together, but it's left brain, right brain.
Well, and I love that you're kind of also touching on something that emerged at the beginning of this episode when we were talking to Malcolm Foley and Andrea Bearfield about shared resources, how we share the assets that we are creating, how that becomes part of not just a redemption narrative when we're looking through the lens that Malcolm brought, in terms of like building equity, equity in every sense of that word, but also how that allows us to empower people with the kind of resources and experiences that makes us all better off. So creating that kind of density of sustainable, downtown, remarkable and distinctive portfolio of spaces also helps us to share those spaces. Share them not just in terms of the economic development portion, but also in terms of the opportunity.
That's right. And having a strong, vibrant center, like it is the symbolic center that people expect to find those cultural events and opportunities, even protest opportunities, like the civic public spaces in the core of your city are where it's the stage for all of that to unfold. And cities that invest in that, they are exemplar cities with great downtowns. And so it's really important, and it sets up this exchange that just feeds the lifeblood of community and cities.
So one of the elements in that, I know kind of part of the first raft of what you're doing is flood remediation, reestablishing ancient waterways, which will help in terms of the flow of water through the land that is downtown. And as I understand it, that brings back into useful, buildable operation acres and acres of land that has been kind of flood prevention at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. I mean, so for all these ingredients to come together and work together, it's not just the public spaces, but it's also the closeness of development to those public spaces. So development including residences, apartments, offices, shops, businesses, to create that highly walkable environment. You have to have close pairing of these great public spaces, whether they're streetscapes or parks, and the businesses that flank that. So this portion, this 30-acre portion of Waco, right off of Washington, has forever been centered on Barron's Branch Creek. And it has a history, if you start thinking about
it. It's in all the old maps, yeah.
It's in all the old maps. It's moved around all over the place over the years, whether by natural erosion or by human influence, but it's this dynamic piece that goes deeper than Waco's settlement history. And so, you know, the way it's been treated in the mid-century of the 1900s was let's bury it. Let's put it underground and manage the water that way so that at least above it we can use the open space for various things. That's its history, or recent history, I guess you'd say. But what that doesn't resolve is the floodplain limitations that keep those businesses out of that area. So we're taking a different approach and also reflecting on that deeper history to say, like, no, this is an essential story of this district. It needs to be visible, manifest, and celebrated. In fact, like, one of the key things that Waco celebrates about itself is we have this gem of Cameron Park, the exposed limestone, the terrain, the river, these great tree canopies. But that was probably characteristic of all the creeks that came through Waco at one time. So this is an opportunity to say, Yes, and. You had Council Member Bearfield on earlier, and this is one of her key phrases, yes, and. So taking what looks like a limitation, but turning it into an opportunity that can be very impactful on how you shape a space in this case. And so, you know, we are doubling the flood capacity underground, but also bringing back this historic flow of Barron's Branch Creek above ground in a controlled way, similar to what San Antonio and Austin have done, and they're great examples. But this is our flag in the ground to say that that character of Cameron Park should be felt in the core of our city as well. And so you'll see some very dramatic images of limestone outcrops and tree canopies. And these are not just aspirational.
And performing arts space beside that Barron's Branch reinstatement too.
So exactly. It sets the stage for how all these other storytelling elements and amenities need to work together to harmonize with that layer of the story. So the Barron's Branch layer sets the tone, and then we have performing arts. We have the performance pavilion in this district. We have plazas that also showcase surrounding landmarks and historical architecture. And then the sculptural infrastructure. We've got a bridge crossing that leans into that and harmonizes with our suspension bridge in a special way. But then there's sculptural art opportunities within this as well. So it becomes the stage setting for setting the tone, but not defining in a box, like this is the story of this space today and forever. It's an invitation for people to come and join in that and help shape the stories going forward. So that exchange, it never ends. And so all we can do is strategically plan the investments that help continue expanding people's gravitational pull to be a part of that.
Beyond that first stage, I know one of the flagship projects is a potential a performing arts center, the CAP, the Center for Culture, Arts, and Performance, which I know is one of the things that Taylor, that we've just heard from, is so passionate about, along with multiple members of our community. Now, I know, you know, that is some way down the pathway. And of course, you know, if anyone out there knows someone with a spare $100 million, we would love to hear from them. And passion for the project, yes. Yeah. But also, why are flagship projects like that such an important part of this vision for Waco's next stage?
It speaks on a number of levels, but just fundamentally, like this, just like the public spaces, public institutions, and even if the management of the facility itself doesn't make it a publicly managed institution, these houses become the living room of a community, if you will, and an embodiment of what our values are. And so we have such a rich and vibrant cultural scene that continues to grow in Waco. It's tremendous. There is no one grand stage for that to take place at the moment. And everybody's kind of making do with the limitations of the facilities that we have. And so like, that's not to disparage or discredit. What this community has accomplished is tremendous. And we have a beautiful history of showing public support and value of each of these key stakeholders to this wider discussion. But within the downtown area, it is an important anchor institution that would fit so well and capture so well what this community is all about, to include front and center a performing arts center that serves our entire region. You know, like the demand is there, the interest is there. It's just, it fits into one of those categories of it's a lofty goal to execute, and it takes time, preparation, and planning. So it continues to be a tentpole priority of the project, and it is placed in an out year of the project sequencing. But really, the key factor, we're decoupling it from, you know, other elements of the project
like
that
the
we thought,
convention
like
center.
The convention center, for example. Let's not let the timing of that limit the timing of the performing arts center. So, you know, the biggest and
that
most
frees it up in terms of being able to align resources around that particular project.
Exactly. So we're excited to continue building support around this initiative and using that support to unlock the timing of its implementation.
I'm very much hoping that, you know, as we look ahead, that this possibility becomes like literally and metaphorically more concrete in the year ahead. But tell me just a little bit about, you know, your top hope for the year ahead? You have a lot on your plate.
Certainly.
What are you hoping for?
It's going to be a heck of a year. 2026 will be momentous in stepping us into the first phase of construction. We've got the project through design. It's in permitting currently for this Barron's Branch district. What we're talking about is just getting the infrastructure, the streetscapes, and the park on the ground. It unlocks many of the other steps for private development and planning the subsequent stages of the 100-acre vision as well. So it's really important to begin strongly, and that is teed up for the second half of 2026. So, we've put together a plan of finance that shows that the city can afford this in a way that doesn't sacrifice its other priorities. So that's really important to our neighbors and our residents to hear that, like, this isn't going to hurt the streets program or park improvements that are going on elsewhere. Again, coming back to that yes and commitment. We've got to be able to do this in a way that unlocks the smart growth, but without sacrificing the stewardship of our other responsibilities. So we've teed all that up. It's been a tremendous amount of work putting all the right pieces in place. But yeah, pending the permitting that's underway right now concerning the floodplain that you mentioned, we should be moving into construction the second half of 26.
Tom, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for what you're doing. Profound thanks to you for really, I know it's like herding cats. You are bringing so many different threads together to create a powerful vision that is now unfolding and now turning into bricks and mortar in our community. So thank you for being able to see our downtown as a canvas. And thank you to you and to Bradley Ford, of course, our city manager, who will be stepping down in February of this year. And I'm excited to see what's next. But I also want to note that Bradley has been a wonderful champion of the arts, of creativity, of that identity for Waco, too. We will miss him very much. And so thank you to Bradley if he is listening.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fiona.
As we wrap up this holiday special, I'm struck by the shared thread across all these conversations. Creativity is courage. Creativity is curiosity. Creativity is a way of imagining and then building something better together. Before we sign off, I want to share some quick invitations. First, Creative Waco has just launched Culturalist, a new platform designed to make creatives in any field discoverable not just locally, but statewide, nationally, and even internationally. It's free to join. And it's one more way we're helping dismantle the barriers to creative careers being attracted to and staying right here in Waco. And second, we'd love to ring in the new year with you. Join us at the AC Hotel in downtown Waco for a New Year's Eve celebration with all the razzmatazz of a night in Vegas while supporting Creative Waco's creative apprenticeships for talented high school artists. You can learn more on the Creative Waco blog that accompanies this episode, and we encourage you to discover live arts and entertainment experiences through wacoinsider.com and the Waco Buzz. A special thank you to the wonderful team at KWBU who do such a terrific job of bringing local programs like this one to you. If you are not yet a contributing member of KWBU, this is your moment. Make it your pre-New Year's resolution and enter the new year glowing with your first success and a good deed. Thank you to our guests today, our guests throughout 2025, to our creative community, and to you, our listeners. I'm Fiona Bond, and this has been Conversations with Creative Waco. Here's to a new year full of imagination, courage, and bold possibility. Happy New Year.